he dropped out of the scholarly world and set out on a journey to find a master. He has been with teachers, great scholars, but none of them was a master. And a master need not be a scholar. It is not a necessity. He may be a scholar. That is accidental. What is necessary and existential is his own knowing, his own experience. So he went in search to find a man who knows himself what is the truth, and who can tell him the way to it. The sutra, beloved Osho, Tozan had a question about whether inanimate objects expound the dharma. Tozan visited Isan, who recommended that he go to see Ungan. His inquiry was whether inanimate objects in the world expound the dharma, the ultimate truth. Whether you can find in the objective world the ultimate truth. That's what science is trying to do. Trying to find into objects the ultimate truth. You cannot find into objects. But this is part of the Zen tradition, that also Isan was himself a master. But he recommended to Tozan to go to see Ungan. Seeing that Tozan is a scholar, Isan was not a scholar. He was a master. He knew his own Buddhahood. But seeing that this man, Tozan, is bound to ask philosophical questions, he sent him to Ungan, who was also a master and a scholar. With Ungan, Tozan was first made aware of the truth, and he composed the following gatha to record his experience. How wonderful, the inanimate expounding the dharma, what an ineffable truth. Ungan told him to be in silence, and as you become silent, everything around you starts expounding the truth. The trees and the mountains, all the objects become suddenly a flame, a fire with truth. If you are sitting silently into your own source of being, then everything in the world indicates towards the ultimate. When he found his source, he wrote this gatha. How wonderful, the inanimate expounding the dharma. What an ineffable truth. If you try to hear it with your ears, you will never understand it. Only when you hear it through the eye, you will really know it. He is indicating about the third eye. As you go inwards, your energy is in the head. First, it has to pass the third eye, going deeper. It will pass through the heart, the fourth center, and the whole energy is at the first center. From there, it can rise to the seventh center in the head. But if you remain hung up in the seventh center only, you will never know. As an experience, what is truth? You have to come down to the depths, to the valleys of your being. You have to reach to the very roots from where you are joined with the whole. Ungan asked him, "Are you happy now?" Tozan answered, "I do not say that. I am not happy. But my happiness is like that of someone who has picked up a bright pearl from a heap of garbage. For a while after his enlightenment, Tozan continued to travel around China. He is saying, unless you see it yourself, there is no other way to know it. You cannot hear it from somebody else. No Buddha can preach it to you. No master can teach it to you. They all can only make gestures. They all can only indicate their finger towards the moon, but the finger is not the moon. You have to drop looking at the finger and to start looking at the moon. When you look at the moon yourself, you know the beauty of it. You cannot know that beauty by looking at the finger pointing to the moon. All knowledge is pointing to the moon. All sutras, all scriptures are pointing to the moon. Just fingers, and people are clinging to the fingers. They have completely forgotten that fingers are not the point. The moon is far away. The finger is only pointing towards it. Don't cling to the finger. Forget the finger. Forget all knowledge, all scriptures, and look at your truth yourself. It is not a question of your ears. It is a question of your very eye, your inner eye. Unless you see inside, you cannot know it by hearing or by reading. Becoming knowledgeable is not becoming a Buddha, but becoming an innocent child, reaching to the sources playfully, without any seriousness, joyously and cheerfully dancing, take your energy to the very source and remain there just for few moments, and you be filled with a new experience which goes on growing every day. Soon one finds filled with the light. Not only filled, the light starts radiating around his body. That's what has been called the aura, and what Wilhelm Reich was trying scientifically to prove it, and was forced in an insane asylum because people could not understand what he is talking about, what radiation he is talking. But now Kirlian photography is able to take the photograph of your life aura around your body. The healthier you are, the bigger is the aura. In your happiness, it dances around you. In your misery, it shrinks. When a miserable person has been used as an object by a Kirlian, he could not find any aura in the photograph. The aura has shrunk inside. But when he has photographed children dancing and enjoying, joyfully plucking the wild flowers or collecting stones on the sea beach, he has found such a tremendous aura around them. The same aura has been found around the Buddhas. It is almost miraculous that no photography was available in the times of Buddha or Krishna. But the paintings, the statues, all have the aura, a round aura around the head. Once you have seen your own life source, you start seeing the same light radiating from every object in the world, every person in the world. You can see through the aura whether the person is miserable or is happy. His master Ungan asked him, "Are you happy now?" Tozan was a scholar and he knew the ways how a Buddha speaks, and now he had himself experienced it. You can see into his answer. He says, "I do not say that I am not happy, but to say I am happy will make it a very ordinary statement. To say that I am happy is not something great. And what I have found is so great that it cannot be described by the word happiness. It is far more. So I will not say I am not happy. You have to understand It is something more than happiness. Words cannot describe it. Only this much I can say, I have found a bright pearl in the heap of garbage. What he is calling the heap of garbage is his scholarship, that he has accumulated so much knowledge unnecessarily, while all that knowledge was only heaping and hiding the original being, your very roots into existence. It is not ordinary happiness. In fact, there is no word that can describe it. Closer comes blissfulness. Even more closer comes benediction. Still more closer comes ecstasy. But beyond that, no word is there. The experience is far deeper than ecstasy itself. For a while after his enlightenment, Tozan continued to travel around China. One day he arrived at Lehtan and met the head monk Chu. Chu greeted Tozan and said, "Wonderful, wonderful, the inconceivable realms of Tao and Buddha." Chu greeted Tozan, and in his greeting he said, "Wonderful, wonderful, the inconceivable realms of Tao and Buddha. I can see in you the very meeting of Buddha and Tao." It is the same experience. Tozan responded, "I don't know about these realms you are talking about." Who is talking of them? He is indicating to Chu that it is beyond words. Look inside yourself. Who is saying these words? From where these words are coming, that source is beyond the words. Chu remained silent, and Tozan shouted, "Speak!" Chu then said, "No need to fight about it. That is the way to miss." Tozan replied, "If it has not been mentioned, how can there be fighting and missing?" Chu could make no answer to this. Tozan then said, "Buddha and Tao, next you will talk of sutras. First you mention of Buddha and Tao, and then you will start talking about sutras. Once you begin to talk, there is no end to talking. And the thing you are trying to talk about is beyond words." Chu replied, "What do the sutras say about this?" Tozan responded, "When all is understood, words are forgotten." Chu said, "This is sickness of the mind." Tozan said, "Is this sickness slight or severe?" Chu could make no reply to Tozan. That was the reason why Isan has sent him to Ungan. He was a man of great scholarship, and once he has found his own Buddha, he will become a very great master. Ordinary teachers will not even be able to understand him. Chu was an ordinary teacher of Tao and Buddhism both. And you can see that Tozan denied even Buddha and Tao. Those words only indicate, they don't describe. And he said to Chu that if you go on, soon you will start talking about sutras. You can see his philosophical approach. Now that he has found the truth, it is very difficult for anybody who is just a scholar even to talk with him. He will be able to defeat any scholarly person very easily. Seeing that Tozan is saying that even Buddha and Tao are not exactly the experience, Chu, as a teacher, said, what do the sutras say about this? He is still talking about sutras. What the sutras say about this unknowable, this inexpressible, you are indicating that it is beyond Buddha and beyond Tao. Tozan said, when all is understood, words are forgotten. Once you have known it, once you have tasted it, you become silent. Of course, a teacher will not be agreeing on this point. Chu in anger said, this is sickness of the mind. Tozan said, is this sickness slight or severe? What kind of sickness? It is not sickness, but a teacher is confined to the mind. You say anything beyond the mind, and you are simply talking nonsense. You are sick, you are mad, you are insane. A teacher is confined to the mind. A master is beyond the mind. Chu could make no reply to Tozan's inquiry whether this sickness is slight or severe. One day, the monk Akinobo went to visit a poet friend of his. Chatting, he mentioned that he had made a collection of poems, one for each day of the year. He read him one. The fourth day of the new year, what better day to leave the world? That very day was the fourth day of the first month of the year, 1718. No sooner had he finished reciting the verse than Akinobo nodded his head and died. Zen masters know how to live and also know how to die. They take neither life seriously nor death seriously. Seriously is a sick way of looking at existence. A man of perfection will love to live and will love to die. His life will be a dance and his death will be a song. There will be no distinction between life and death. Manisha's question, beloved Osho, the philosopher Carl Jaspers writes in volume 3 of his book, Philosophy, to ask real questions about reality, man must have thought, investigated, and oriented himself by distinctions. Real is what can be measured, what our senses can perceive in space and time according to rules, what can be controlled or calculated at least by appropriate measures. Would you like to comment? Manisha, Carl Jaspers is a great philosopher, but he is not a master. What he is saying is the definition of matter. Exactly, the word matter comes from the Sanskrit word matra. Matra means that which can be measured. Matter means that which can be measured. And that which cannot be measured is your reality. Carl Jaspers is confusing reality with matter. Matter is real, but reality is far more than the matter. It also includes consciousness, which is not measurable. You cannot measure it. By any means, how many feet of consciousness you have, or how many miles, or how many clothes. Matter is that which can be measured, and consciousness is that which cannot be measured. And Jaspers is containing himself, confining himself to matter as the only reality. He is absolutely wrong. About matter he is right, but about reality he is wrong, because reality is much more than matter. Even Carl Jaspers cannot say how many clothes of consciousness he has. There is no way of measuring consciousness. And certainly, even Carl Jaspers cannot deny that he has no consciousness. Who is denying? I am reminded of a small story about Mullah Nasruddin. he was talking about his generosity to the friends in a restaurant. The friend said, "You are simply talking about generosity, but we have never seen any generous act on your part. You have not even invited us for a cup of tea." Mullah said, "Come on, you are all invited, the whole crowd in the restaurant. Come to my home for the dinner." They could not believe. They knew that this man is a very miserly man. He has been caught just because he was boasting about his generosity. As they were approaching closer to the home, he became aware about the wife, that he has brought a trouble to himself unnecessarily. Now how he is going to convince his wife? In the first place, he has gone in the morning to fetch some vegetables and he has not returned till evening, and now he is coming with a crowd. So he told the crowd that, "You understand the problem between husband and wife. You just remain outside few minutes. First let me go in to convince my wife that I have invited few friends." So he went in, closing the door, and told the wife that by mistake he has invited a crowd. Now you have to be a help to me. The wife said, "What I can do? There is nothing in the house. You have been away the whole day, not even vegetables." Mullah Nasruddin said, "That is not the question. You simply go on the door and ask the people why they are crowding there. Obviously they will say that I have invited them for the dinner." You simply deny. You simply say that Mullah Nasruddin has not been home since morning. You just go and tell them that, "Go away, he is not here." The wife was puzzled, but something has to be done. She opened the door and Mullah Nasruddin was watching from the second story window what happened. The wife said that, "He is not in the house. For whom you are waiting?" They said, "He has come with us and he has gone before us. We are all witnesses. He has invited us for the dinner. Perhaps you don't know. He has gone inside the house." The wife said, "He is not inside the house." He said, "This is strange. We have come with him. He has told us to wait here. You just go in and find out. He must be inside watching or looking for you." The wife would not let them in. The crowd tried to go in. The crowd said, "We are all friends to your husband. Let us look in." Mullah, seeing the situation, shouted from the upper story that this is absolute nonsense. When she is saying he is not in, he is not in. Don't you feel ashamed? challenging a poor woman. He may have come with you, but he may have gone from the back door out again. And he is talking himself. Just ask Carl Jaspers, is your consciousness miserable? If he denies that he has no consciousness, then who is denying? Either he has to deny or he has to accept. But in every case, even his denial will be a proof of consciousness. This is a strange thing about not only Carl Jaspers, but about all philosophers of the world. They go on continuing saying that only matter exists. Because the matter can be experienced by eyes, by ears, by hands, by all your senses, it can be measured. Hence, it is the only reality. But the truth is that even those who deny the existence of the immeasurable are accepting, even in their denial, the consciousness. Otherwise, who is denying? It is very amazing that great intellectuals like Carl Jaspers, a very respectable philosopher of this century, talks like a stupid man. But all philosophers talk like a stupid man. Is saying that only that which can be measured is real is absolutely wrong. That which can be measured is matter, and that which cannot be measured is also real, but it is consciousness. Our search is for the immeasurable. The measurable can be left to the scientists. The mystics are concerned with the immeasurable. Now it is time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. Captain Codfish, the old pirate, is in the stoned seagull pub one night telling stories from his life at sea. I had a parrot once, declares Codfish, drinking his rum. He was the most incredible word. He could imitate anything. Charlie Chaplin, Jack the Ripper, Marilyn Monroe, Pope the Polar, even Nancy Reagan. Wow, says Igor, the barman. Where is he? What happened to him? Ah, cries the old pirate. Times got hard and I got hungry. I ate him. You ate your parrot? Cries Igor in disgust. What did he taste like? He tasted just like turkey, replies Codfish. That parrot could imitate anything. Paddy has a late night at the pub, and when it closes, he staggers outside in a drunken stupor. he wanders around the streets trying to remember which way to go home and finally gives up. Paddy sits down on the street and looks all around him until a taxi pulls up beside him. Ah, groans Paddy, clambering into the back and laying down on the seat. Can you take me to number 5 Fergus Street? The cab driver looks around at Paddy and replies, "Hey mister, this is number 5 Fergus Street." Ah, groans Paddy, "All right, but next time don't drive so fast." On a foggy morning in Vienna, Austria, the two famous psychoanalysts, Dr. Siegfried Mind and Dr. Crazy Karl Kang, meet in the little brown Danube cafe over a table seat with coffee and cream cakes. Dr. Kang suddenly jumps up, grabs Siegfried by the neck and shakes him. "We must go to this time," shouts Karl. "We have tried 6 times already. We must go to the pyramids in Egypt to see the mummies." "Mummies?" screeches Siegfried, collapsing into the cream cakes in a dead faint. Dr. Kang pours coffee on Dr. Mind's head until he recovers. "Come on, Mind," cries Dr. Kang, slapping him across the face. "We can do it. We have to explore this mystery of death." "Death?" screeches Mind, and he faints again into the plate of cream cakes. Half an hour later, at the Vienna airport, Dr. Crazy Karl Kang is dragging Dr. Siegfried Mind by the collar onto the plane bound for Cairo. "Come on, Mind," cries Crazy Kang, huffing and puffing. "We have made it this far. We have got to see those mummies." "Mummies?" screams Siegfried, falling in a faint on top of Nellie Knickers, the stewardess. Kang and Nellie drag Mind to his seat and strap him down. The plane takes off and 3 hours later arrives in the land of the pyramids. Kang carries the babbling Dr. Mind to the herd of rented camels which are waiting to take them to the Pharaoh's tombs. Dr. Kang shouts out to their guide, "Abdul Babul, take us to the mummies." "Mummies?" screeches Mind, fainting and falling straight off his camel, nose first into a sand dune. 2 days later, the famous psychoanalysts and their camels arrive at the huge pyramids. Dr. Kang jumps down, lights a torch, grabs Dr. Mind by the collar, and starts dragging him into the dark, mysterious crypts. Suddenly, in the darkness, Dr. Kang tips over something. "What is that?" screeches Mind. "Ah, it is all right. It is only a dead cat," exclaims Dr. Kang. "Death?" screeches Mind, and he falls over in a cold faint. "Pull yourself together, doctor," shouts Kang. "We are almost there." And Kang grabs Siegfried by the suit and drags him first feet towards a huge golden coffin. "Stand up," cries Dr. Kang, propping Mind up against the wall and hanging him the burning torch. Then crazy Karl Kang bends over and lifts back the heavy cracking coffin lid. The lid falls to the ground with a loud crash, and when the dust clears, Dr. Kang is left standing with his mouth wide open, gazing at the spooky sight before his eyes. He turns and grabs the frozen Dr. Mind by the collar and pulls his face down into the coffin. "There," shouts Kang in triumph, "this is mummy." "Mummy?" screeches Siegfried, but he just stares in disbelief with his eyes popping out. "Mummy?" he screeches again. "Hey, this looks more like daddy." It is time, definitely. Close your eyes and feel yourself completely frozen. This is the right moment to enter inwards. Gather all your energy, your total consciousness, and rush towards the inner center with deep intensity and urgency. The center is just 2 inches below the navel inside the body. Faster and faster, deeper and deeper. As you come closer to the center of being, a great silence descends over you, and inside, a peace, a blissfulness, a light that fills your whole interior. This is your original being. This is your Buddha. At this moment, witness that you are not the body, not the mind, not the heart, but just the pure witnessing self, the pure consciousness. This is your Buddhahood, your hidden nature, your meeting with the universe. These are your roots. Relax, Nivedanam. Relax and just be a silent witness. You start melting like ice in the ocean. Go Gautam, the Buddha auditorium, becomes an oceanic field of consciousness. You are no more separate. This is your oneness with existence. To be one with existence is to be a Buddha. It is your very nature. It is not a question of searching and finding. You are it right now. This is the meaning of this series, the awakening of the Buddha. Gather all the flowers, the fragrance, the flame and the fire. The immeasurable. And bring it with you as you come back. Nivedana, come back peacefully, silently, as a Buddha. Just for a few seconds, close your eyes and remember the path and the source you have found and the Buddha nature that you have experienced. This moment, you are the most blessed people on the earth. Remembering yourself as a Buddha is the most precious experience, because it is your eternity, it is your immortality. It is not you, it is your very existence. You are one with the stars and the trees and the sky and the ocean. You are no more separate. The last word of Buddha was Sammasati. Remember that you are a Buddha. Sammasati. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, sir.